I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The number of men accused of sexual misconduct and assault continues to mount. Industries and institutions, from sports and entertainment to politics, have been affected. So too have countless women and men. The allegations made depict widespread, despicable behavior. It's clear that proven violators should be punished and victims deserve redress, but no two instances are exactly alike. So how do you make sure that punishment matches the crime? And what do we owe the victims? Today we ask the ethics professors to unravel many of the moral dilemmas wrapped up in the reckoning over sexual misconduct in the workplace. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Sexual harassment is all in the news these days, and one big question is there a statute of limitations when it comes to sexual harassment? We're going to kick around that topic this morning, and also we're going to start with an issue involving Santa Claus. That's coming up right now with our ethics professors. They are Wayne Vaught. He's dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics. He's one of my bosses at UMKC. Wayne, it's always good to have you. Welcome back.
Good to be here, Steve.
Clancy Martin is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. Clancy, good morning to you.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
Okay. Let's do this. We're going to table sexual harassment just for a couple minutes. We're waiting for a guest or two, hopefully, to show up here. Let's turn to a different topic, and that is Santa Claus. We probably should forewarn listeners here, if they have little ones listening, maybe they want to mute this conversation because we're going to speak, frankly, about Santa Claus here. Clancy, the existence of a naughty or nice list, is it really right to teach kids to behave only the right way when there's some reward for them if they do so?
Well, I think we all respond to rewards and punishments, carrots and sticks, when we're thinking about behavior. And it's a big part of parenting, mm-hmm. finding appropriate carrots and sticks. Now, some parents might worry about, let's say, appropriate carrots and sticks for truthfulness mm-hmm. when they're appealing to fictional characters, let's say.
Right. Why does Santa treat poor people differently, Wayne? I mean, when kids end up comparing what they receive from Santa, what message is sent to little ones who find out that maybe Santa gave more and better gifts to some kids and maybe not to others? And how can parents deal with that thorny ethical dilemma here?
Well, you know, that is a challenge, and one I actually hadn't
yes,
thought about in a whole lot of detail. And obviously, Santa is not necessarily selecting whom he gives the best toys to based mm-hmm. on who's actually had the best behavior in that regard. You know, I think that this is just a situation that really brings the parent appealing to Santa Claus to this existential crisis of, mm-hmm. well, how do I address this in a way that's meaningful? And there's nothing I think that really you can say other than kind of going deeper into the rabbit hole of trying to provide sub-justifications for the lie you've told in the first place to try to create a nice, pleasant event for your child. So
that's an interesting point, this whole notion that, hopefully our listeners are paying heed here and turning off radios if little right. ones are listening, because we're talking very frankly about Saint Nick right now.
Right.
But, in the eyes of many, Saint Nick is not always an actual person, and there is a notion that this is all a little bit of a fabrication. And what about all that?
Well, it's part of an interesting question, because you're coming up, you know, we're talking about deception and lying as a way of setting up a reward system that rewards good behaviors for people to get them to engage in morally appropriate behavior, which lying is one that we typically think of as not being a particularly morally appropriate sort of behavior. So the whole thing just creates some interesting ethical dilemmas for us. And I think for some reasons, that's why some parents kind of eschew the whole process and say, well, for whether it be religious reasons or otherwise, we're not going to do the Santa sort of thing. Other than some will say, you know, there's the spirit of Santa, or there are different ways of getting around the spirit of giving, the spirit of the season, and that's what it really is about. It's not about the quantity of the gifts that you're getting or whatever it may be. But you know, this whether it's being on the good list, the bad list, you know, I've said before, you know, to my kids, they're getting lumps of coal or whatever for Christmas or sticks. That's what, you know, if you keep doing this sort of behavior, Santa's going to bring you a lump of coal. That's what I was told. That's what I do now. And it's simple behaviorism at its fundamental. What you're trying to do is, you know, a kid acts badly and you want to give them a reward or a punishment for the behavior, so that becomes, you know, they enjoy the good feeling of acting well. They enjoy the bad feeling associated with a poor choice. And then I guess you hope as they go on and we kind of take the training wheels off moral indoctrination or moral growth and development, that they then like the good feeling that comes from doing good. And which is what Christmas ultimately, you know, all the shows that we'll be watching is what Christmas, they'll say, is ultimately supposed to be about, that warm feeling that one gets from doing good, but just being a person of good spirit. So that's part of, I think, ultimately what's going on. We just, you know, kind of go a little bit overboard, and then you start these deceptive practices, but then it leads
deceptive
to
practices.
It leads
that's
to
a way to put
a
it.
Next one, and then to a next one, and then boom, there you are. Well,
Clancy, what about this notion of deceptive practices when it comes to Christmas, which, after all, is a religious holiday, and many religions would suggest that being deceptive is not part of what they're all about. And how do you square all this?
Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the great.
There he is. There you're bringing in our savior.
Heavyweight.
Yeah, the great theologian and ethicist who, you know, died in a Nazi concentration camp wrote about this. And he was in his book Ethics, and he's talking about the notion of what he called a living truth. The distinction between living truth and literal truth is often it is the case that we are incapable of giving an adequate account, particularly in the case of morality, of some principle that we all recognize to be enormously important. So, for example, if you try to justify to anyone else the principle of generosity, it gets very complicated very quickly, despite the fact that we all have an intuitive feeling that generosity is important. Mm-hmm. And this is why, on Bonhoeffer's account, Bonhoeffer, deeply religious man, very committed to the Old and New Testament. He insisted that many of the stories, most of the stories in the Bible, were examples of living truth, fictional narratives that, which in his mind, God was using in order to make a more fundamental moral point.
Right.
So, and if you think about the stories that motivate you as a moral person, the stories that make you a good father or made you a good child, make you a good professor, whatever it is that you consider the particular moral domains you operate in, a lot of those stories are probably not strictly factual stories, and they're not theoretical accounts that you have given yourself that you know are based on the truth. They're kind of lived experiences that you believe, despite the fact that you're not absolutely certain that, oh yes, all of this is true or it's 100% true. Similarly, for a story like Santa Claus, for this kind of stories we tell ourselves about our republic, et cetera, you can communicate a principle like generosity, like being kind to others, even when it doesn't immediately benefit you.
Right.
And a person can actually learn this. The communication can be successful.
Right.
When it is, for him, appropriately morally motivated.
You know, I'm wondering, along these lines, there's this whole notion of donating time and money to various organizations at this time of year, Clancy, and the holidays typically see a spike in charitable contributions this time of year. You know, what about this idea that, you know, someone might like a lot of the work that an organization does, but maybe there are one or two major positions the organization takes that disagree with your own moral view of the world? I'm thinking about the Salvation
Salvation Army, for example, finding difficulty and problems with people who are gay. They find that practice unacceptable, that lifestyle unacceptable. So do you donate there? Do you not donate there? How do you choose that?
Well, in my opinion, I do think they are related issues, because I think that one of the reasons that we might be tempted to say, no, some stories are true and other stories are false, and we're just going to sort them out into those camps. We're only going to tell true stories, and we're not going to tell any stories that we believe to be false or know to be false, is that we are thinking in these absolutist terms. Mm-hmm. And when we are moral absolutists, life gets easier, because you can sort everything into black and white, but in a sense easier. And it's not a very morally realistic picture of what it is to be a human being.
Right.
I mean, would you rather sort things into maximal good and no good, or do you want to find some middle area where you say, well, I can do a little good this way by contributing, let's say, to the Salvation Army, even though I don't support every aspect of their mission?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, my students will sometimes come to me and say, oh, I understand that you don't believe in killing animals for biomedical research. And I'll say, yes, that's true. And they'll say, well, but I see that you wear leather shoes. And I said, that's true too. And it is an inconsistency, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But whether we're thinking about eating animals, killing animals, or we're thinking about the kinds of narratives we tell, our intentions are relevant, and or charities we donate to, our intentions in donating to those charities are morally relevant. And we always have to ask ourselves this question about, well, can I do a little good, or can I do a little less harm?
Mm-hmm.
And I think those intuitions are always morally relevant and ultimately morally praiseworthy,
right,
as long as the good is intended.
Let's do this. Let's have our listeners chime in here on these big issues surrounding the holidays here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Murad from Harrisonville.
Yes.
Am I saying that right? Murad?
No, I'm here.
Welcome. Yeah, you're on the air.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you very much for having me on the air. I like the topic, because it's something that I've toyed with a buddy of mine.
I think a lot of people do.
Yeah, right. And the idea is that we live in a world where there's a lot of truths coming to light. And in the show just before this one, they talked about people's fears and safety and the things that are familiar to them. So now your show is talking about Santa, and I'm thinking, okay, this is good. And then someone said that there was this guy who called it a living lie or something or another. And I thought, this is something I discuss. And I thought, well, if you teach a child that they're going to get something good if they act nice, and most times the average child is not being good all year round, and if you this was a real thing, most of them would probably be on the naughty list. Yet they still get presents. So if this happens that way in their formative stage, formative years, doesn't that leak out and start to become a part of their moral way of seeing things?
Yeah, what do you think about that, Clancy?
I think it's a fair question.
Yeah, right.
About are we rewarding bad behavior, or I suppose the heart of the question is something like, are we rewarding hypocrisy? Like, am I getting presents pretending to be good, even though I've been naughty a lot of the year and Santa still managed to keep me on the good list, so I just know that I have to hide my naughty behaviors from Santa? I think, again, with the notion of Santa Claus, we are, and tying it to moral education in our children, we are not teaching them to hide their naughty deeds or something like that. I think we are teaching them something about the notion of generosity, the notion of, right, on the whole, were you good? On the whole, were you naughty? I mean, it is certainly not the case, I'm sure, that even the naughtiest of of our political leaders right now got cheated out of their presents at Christmas because they were naughty children. And maybe we should be a little bit concerned about that. We give our children moral education in a variety of ways. But I think actually maybe it's nice if at Christmas even the naughty ones get presents right. from Santa, because then we learn something about forgiveness.
On that note, let's take a break here. We were trying to buy a little time so we can set up our next segment, which is going to deal with the whole issue of sexual harassment and this idea of, is there a statute of limitations on sexual harassment? One of our guests wasn't able to make it right at the top of the show. A woman, we want a woman on this panel. She's now with us. So let's break. When we come back, we'll launch into sexual harassment and all that, all the issues surrounding that issue here. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. We're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we spoke with Gold Star Father Keyser Khan, who was the star of the 2016 Democratic National Convention, on his latest thoughts on President Donald Trump. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, the application deadline for the ACA Marketplace is December 15th. We'll tell you tomorrow how, where, and when you and your family can get enrolled in health insurance. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, is there a statute of limitations on sexual harassment? It's a question that comes up in the wake of all these reports of harassment involving high-profile journalists, entertainers, and, of course, politicians. Some of the alleged offenses, now generating outcries, occurred years ago, even back in the 1980s. Is there such a thing as too long ago or not? When ethical questions like this come up, that's what we're going to talk about here with our ethics professors. Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin from UMKC are still with us. We're joined now by Brenda Bethman, who's director of the UMKC Women's Center. And Brenda, it's nice to have you as well. Thank you. Well, let's launch right into this here. Should there be a statute of limitations, so to speak, when it comes to sexual misconduct? The accusations against Roy Moore, the Alabama Senate candidate, all occurred before 1985. Those against Senator Al Franken of Minnesota occurred in 2006, 2007, and 8, and 2010. Trump's Access Hollywood tape is from 2005, and the latest report of sexual misconduct is 2013. Question, how fair is it to go back into a person's past and then draw the line there? Brenda, what do you think?
So I think that to a large extent, it kind of depends on the reaction. So to have done something not very serious 30 years ago and have remorse about it is a different thing than, you know, to continue have done it, which a lot of the cases going on now are repeated offenses like Weinstein and so on. And to not have grown from it or acknowledged that anything was wrong with it, I think is where it gets problematic for me.
You know, some of these things, Wayne Vaught, involving Roy Moore, the Senate candidate from Alabama, again, occurred in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. You know, in some cases, in some crimes, there are no statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. Murder, for example. And mm-hmm. sometimes sexual misconduct against kids falls into that category. Mm-hmm. How do you size this thing up?
Well, I couldn't comment on the issues of the legality issues of statutes of limitations and things. You know, there's the moral implications, though. I mean, there's no statute of limitations on the harms that are inflicted on these children, on these women, many of whom are living for decades, and obviously decades, that they're coming out now. And children who speak up in their 30s, their 40s, their 50s to talk about the experience of sexual abuse that they experience as children shows that there's certainly no statute of limitations on the pain that the victims have felt. And so that I think that kind of puts into perspective in part what we're starting to see here. And I think Brenda's comment is exactly right. You know, when you're thinking about people coming forward with allegations now, making public allegations, you know, I think in some way a rock has been turned over, and there are a number of changes that have occurred in the past decades that have really allowed this to occur. The social media, the direct access of communications, these are things that probably would not have been picked up by mainstream media, and certainly with political leaders we know in the past, and there are JFK and others who sort of historically had behaviors right. that the media kind of left alone. we're no longer in that world. This is a world where the discovery of facts and information is much more easily and self-directedly made very public. And so with that comes, of course, on the flip side, you have the issue of the media responsibility of ensuring accuracy of data and facts. And some of that gets lost in the ability to quickly put out things and respond to things.
So going back to the central question here then, at least at this moment, is there a statute of limitations? Should there be one when it comes to sexual misconduct? Where are you coming down on that?
Well, again, this is getting back to, I think, Brenda's point. If we're talking about an assessment of the moral character of an individual or someone's suitability to serve us, particularly in a public role, which is what we're seeing with these legislators, we're asking ourselves, does the person have the moral character in order to be an effective and fair representative? And again, if something happened...
So that question is a valid question for voters to consider when they go to the polls in Alabama.
Absolutely. I'll let Brenda speak on that. But yeah, absolutely, it's a valid point. Now, if there were some... I don't know what you would consider a minor infraction back to 3 decades ago, but if there were some issue that came up, I mean, rape is obviously something that I don't think we would consider a minor issue no matter when it happened, and that would come out now. Yeah, I think that's something potentially legitimate. It is legitimate for the voters to be concerned about, but and Brenda pointed out, you know, we're concerned not just about individual behaviors, but patterns of behaviors and the moral character. And, you know, someone obviously can change and have remorse and be a much different person than they were. You know, they go to prison and they're out and have sort of fundamentally changed who they are. And I think we need to take that into consideration.
If our listeners want to chime in here on this question of statutes of limitations when it comes to sexual misconduct, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Clancy Martin, one thing some commentators have pointed out is that there are different levels here of misconduct. I mean, certainly what Roy Moore is accused of is a different thing than what Al Franken is accused of at this moment, as would apply to Garrison Keillor. Talk about that and how we, some sense, the media is lumping everybody into the same camp, same category in some ways.
Well, I think that is true and relevant, that making news is also part of the story here. And the, as Wayne pointed out, the part of how we get confused by social media is that we do have sometimes these phenomena sort of grow and grow, and we get ourselves into a climate of hysteria. I think that in the most of the examples, maybe all of the examples we've talked about so far, it is, as Wayne said, we've turned over a rock on a behavior and set of behaviors that have gone hidden in this country for much too long.
It's been sudden and it's been dramatic.
Yeah, and it's been healthy, I think, very healthy for the country to have everybody's attention called to this and to have people who are out there engaging in these behaviors now or who have considered engaging in these behaviors finally recognizing in a very clear way, okay, this is absolutely always unacceptable. And this is what we need for behavior to change. That said, we do need to hold the media accountable for high standards of accuracy and truthfulness. And we don't want to turn this into a witch hunt because we don't want innocent people to get caught up in it as well, which is, of course, always a possibility.
I mean, is a grope by Franken in the same category as an alleged rape by Harvey Weinstein?
Clearly not.
Well, mm-hmm.
Brenda, go ahead.
Brenda, yeah, jump in here.
But it's a continuum, right, of behaviors that serve to exclude women from positions. So we, you know, Wayne pointed out there's no statute of limitations on people's pain. There's also no statute of limitations on all the lost potential, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know off the top of my head the percentage of women who leave tech industry jobs, but it's huge, and it's because they're being harassed.
Sure.
And it's groping is absolutely qualitatively different than a rape, but it still serves to drive women out of certain jobs and certain industries. And so I think you know, where do we draw the line? We draw the line at mutual consent, and that's clearly not happening.
Hey, how significant of a turn has the society made, Brenda, to go back to Clancy's point? How are you seeing this moment in time for this country right now?
So it feels similar in some ways, and I do wonder if there's going to be a real change. You know, it's interesting as someone who's taught and done this for many years to hear people talking about this as if it's something new or we didn't know what was going on. You know, women have known this has been going on since forever. So it's not a new thing. And the question is
but society's grappling with it as a new thing, I think.
Yeah. Well, but there's still, my perspective is that we're still holding it up as individual men when it's a systemic structure of sexism that we need to look at changing. So it's like racism is the same way, right? So you can go after individual racists, or you can go after individual sexists and harassers, but unless we change the entire structure of rewards and the way that system functions to exclude people, it's not going to be real deep change, and we'll be here again in 10 years.
I'm wondering how optimistic you are as head of the UMKC Women's Center about that needed change taking place.
Maybe in the middle. It's probably the biggest conversation I've seen in my lifetime, for sure. Although, you know, we did this with Anita Hill, and that was a long time ago.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
And so that becomes the question, is are people willing to really look at the bigger structures? And I don't know if I have a good answer for that.
Yeah. Question on the table, is there a statute of limitations when it comes to sexual misconduct? We're talking about this in the wake of all this, these reports of sexual harassment involving high-profile journalists, entertainers, and politicians. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR. Up to date, we're joined today by our ethics professors. Let's go to Patrick from Leawood. Patrick, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I was involved in the priest abuse case in Kansas City, Missouri, St. Joseph Diocese. And in that, I was both an employee of one of these abusive priests. The attempted abuse happened to me. And I was told that the statute of limitations on it was 3 years, within 3 years of having a repressed memory come forward. So let's say this abuse happened 20 years ago. You had to be told somewhere, you know, you had to come up to this realization that this happened to you. It had to be within 3 years, otherwise the case was null and void. I thought that was kind of a very odd law. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Who wants to hop in there?
Well, again, you're getting into the issues of the legality,
yes,
and,
right,
and the ability to prosecute particular types of offenses, and I think that's something that is certainly relevant, but I would need a legal expert here to give us some insight into that. You know, what we've been thinking about more is the moral concerns and conflicts here and moral assessment and engagement, and how do we interact, or how do we respond, or how do we punish people, not from a legal sense, not is some prosecutor going to come forward with some charges, but what we're seeing now in terms of the people who are losing their jobs isn't a prosecutorial issue. It's a matter of employers or society,
right,
at large taking
And Patrick is asking about the legal questions here.
Right. So these are the legal questions, which I'm just not in a position to answer. You know, I think fundamentally, and one of the points I think that Brenda's brought up really well is that this is an institutional problem. It's sort of like it is like institutional racism. This is institutional sexual gender discrimination, which creates barriers for women to be successful and have on equal footing with men in a workplace. And whether that's, you know, subtle touching or looks or comments in the halls or actual groping or rape or on this whole continuum, there are a series of practices, and there has been a cultural of acceptance of varying sorts of behaviors within the workplace that have allowed this to grow to a point where, you know, we're finding, we turned over this rock and we're just seeing all of these horrific stories. And, you know, the difficult thing for us is to step back and think, well, what is it as a culture and what is it as a community that's allowed this sort of thing to go on? Because as Brenda said, it's not a surprise to women at all that this is going on. We've known that it's been going on for a long time. Why have we just now really been able to come forward and do something about
Brenda, what would you like to see happen when it comes to this question of statutes of limitations, given the long-term damage that you've outlined so eloquently here this morning?
I think for kids, for sure, I don't think there should be a statute of limitations for stuff that happened when you were so young, because as the caller just pointed out, people have repressed memories and comes up a lot later.
How about a 22-year-old woman who hopes to launch a career and winds up leaving an industry because something horrific happened to her at work? And her life has changed as a result.
So are we talking legal, moral,
I guess
security? I don't know if I feel qualified to answer the legal question because I'm not a lawyer and I don't really know enough about the law. But I don't have a problem with holding people to a moral standard much later. And especially as we have discussed earlier, especially people who don't see that what they did was wrong.
Right. Okay.
So when an accusation comes up and they say, well, you know, I was just trying to take her out on a date, that's a different thing than true understanding of remorse and change, I think.
Right. Let's go to Carla from Lawrence. Carla, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi. It's almost more of a statement than a question. I was really struck by the fact that you have three men, counting you, and a woman talking about this issue when, number one, I'd really prefer to hear a panel of women. And I keep hearing one of the panelists talk over Brenda and say, as Brenda said, you know, a man, again, kind of explaining what she already said, when really I just want to hear what she has to say.
Okay. Carla, I appreciate that. I appreciate your thoughts. Let's go to Kristen from Kansas City, Missouri. Kristen, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to chime in and say that it isn't just a issue that starts with sexual misconduct. It starts with just pure sexism. I myself have been in the business world and working in management, and I've had a male give me hand cream one time because he told me that my hands look scaly and it's inappropriate for a woman's hands to look that way. And, you know, I do hard work, and sorry if my hands don't look appropriate. But that puts fear into women, and it slowly starts to erode a woman's reaction to what men do, and it continues to progress. And I myself have been a victim of sexual misconduct, and I realize it's from fear, because men are allowed to continuously make these kinds of comments and have their own thoughts and opinions pressed upon women, and no one says anything because they're in a place of higher power.
How confident are you, Kristen, that we've reached a turning point in society given the recent wave of stories about so many high-profile men right now?
You know, I think it's definitely helping. For me, myself, with what I've gone through, it was giving me a breath of fresh air. But honestly, I think when it comes down to even the stuff that I have dealt with here in Kansas City, I don't think it's going to change much, because from what I've heard from men is it's just women complaining and women coming out so much later. Well, we've been stifled. We have been pushed down and have had fear shoved down our throats for so long that we're afraid. And we've been told that we need men to protect us. Well, how can a man protect us when they're the ones doing the violence? And it needs to be women protecting themselves and women looking out for women. No longer are men able to protect us because they're the ones causing all the violence.
Brenda Bethman, what about this notion of women being stifled for so long that Kristen is talking about here?
No, I think she's absolutely right. That is, when I said earlier, there's a continuum. It's a continuum of sexism. It's things, you know, as small as making a comment in a meeting, which everyone ignores, and then a man says it, and suddenly it's the best idea ever. I don't know any woman that hasn't happened to. But the stifling, too, comes from the culture of fear, as she pointed out, and, you know, you're going to lose your job and not be able to pay your mortgage and feed your kids if you make a complaint. So women have, and some men have, put up with a lot of harassment out of fear for not being able to provide for themselves and their families.
Hmm. You know, Clancy Martin, I'm wondering, is an apology such as the one made by Al Franken enough here? Or is some sort of penance required, be it losing a job, a company, his Senate seat? How do you see that?
Well, I do think it's an important question, especially for people on the left right now, because we're all very happy to see Roy Moore pay some kind of political price for his misconduct, and we might be much more inclined to forgive Al Franken, and maybe we're not being entirely sincere in our motivations when we draw some of these lines. We don't force anyone to go into politics. We don't force anyone to become a leader in the media. These are professions that do bring with them these high profiles, and you do get held out as a kind of representative. And if you are a representative who's shown really morally reprehensible behavior, it probably ought to cost you something. Now, as Brenda said, I think that forgiveness is also a relevant moral factor here. And when someone is contrite, recognizes their wrongdoing, apologizes sincerely for the wrongdoing, we have an opportunity to evaluate. Is this an appropriate time for forgiveness, or do we need something more than an apology? And I think it does have to be sort of deliberated in public, like we're doing right mm-hmm. now, talked mm-hmm. about, thought about. And I do think that we want to model both appropriate moral behavior when it comes to how we treat each other and appropriate moral behavior when we're thinking about has justice been done here or not?
No, Brenda, these are really tough questions, but this notion of forgiveness, how do you evaluate that and where do you place that into the overall equation here of how society should view people like the Al Frankens and the Garrison Keillors and the Roy Moores?
Oh, Steve, you're asking the hard questions today.
This is tough. I know I am, and I almost want to apologize. It's tough stuff. Yeah.
I mean, forgiveness, I think, you know, that can't come from those of us who weren't victimized by those people. So I don't know exactly where to place that. And I don't know how relevant I think it is to their continuing anyway. You can forgive people and still hold them accountable and still expect them to pay a price.
Mm-hmm. That's
right?
Interesting.
So we can say we forgive you, Al Franken, but we still don't think you should continue to be a senator. Or I'm not going to go there, but, you know, we forgive you, Matt Lauer, but you don't need to be on TV anymore.
Yeah.
Or whoever or whatever. So I think that they're not necessarily related.
That's interesting.
Does that make
wait,
sense?
Yeah, absolutely, Brenda. Wayne, take a
That's
crack
one of those
at that.
Questions I need to call you back next week, probably. Cause yeah.
believe me, I just sit here and ask the questions, and I'm glad that I do. Wayne, how do you size that up?
I think there are two fundamentally different issues. Well, one, you're talking about public forgiveness, but there really is the issue of the apology and the forgiveness of the people who have been offended. But that really is that's one issue. The second issue is one about an assessment of an individual's ability to, particularly in leadership roles in the legislature, whether we can make a determination, does this person have the, not just the intellectual skills, but the moral skills, the moral ability to play that particular role. And that's a decision that's separate from the issue of the forgiveness from the offender and the person who has been victimized.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there, and what an interesting conversation it was. Brenda Bethman, director of UMKC Women's Center. Thanks so much, Brenda. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Wayne Vaught, dean of the UMKC College of Arts and Sciences. Clancy Martin, a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC. Thank you both very much. Appreciate
Thanks for
it.
Having
Thanks,
Steve.
So we enjoyed it.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
Moon River, wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. Oh, dream maker, you heartbreaker,
Wherever you're going, I'm going your way. Two drifters off to see the world. There's such a lot of world to see.
You know, I love that song. I love the way Andy Williams sings it.
Oh, yeah.
Brian McTavish is here to talk about some cool stuff to do in this weekend.
And, I am.
And we're talking about Andy Williams and Moon River because...
We are in for a double treat at Christmas on the River on Main Street in downtown Parkville.
What a wonderful Main Street that is.
Oh, my gosh. It's just, you can see the river.
Yes.
You can go down there. So that's why it's called Christmas on the River. Now, it is officially the 24th annual River Fest, featuring not only 1,000 voices of children plucked eagerly from the Park Hill School District, 1,000 kids singing, you get Santa Claus. But get this, why are we listening to Moon River? Well, because we're Andy Williams freaks. But it's not just about the river, it's about the moon. This weekend.
That's right. That's
this
right.
weekend, Very we are going to get to see what they call
the supermoon.
And I love super things. You know, Superman, super this, super that.
Super Bowl.
Super Bowl, especially. Good
no
luck, Chiefs.
No.
I say no.
No.
I beat you to the no.
No, it's not going to happen.
Okay, yes, then. They're going to make it. I'm glad you talked me into it.
No,
they're going all the way. Anyway,
okay.
The supermoon, it's like this fantastically large, big in the sky moon. It will be virtually full on Friday night from 6 to 10 downtown Parkville during Christmas on the River. It actually hits fruition Sunday night, early Monday. But hey, go have fun with the kids and Santa and the big fat full moon in Parkville.
What do we have here?
Well, we have the, and I'm going to say this wrong, but that's the way that goes. Maybe I'll say it right. Ubuntu Conscious Music Festival. It's 2 days of diverse bands honoring what they call, and I agree, human sovereignty and the rights of indigenous and native people everywhere. It kicks off noon Sunday and comes back at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Monday at the Uptown Theater. What does Ubuntu mean in Zulu? Well, I'll tell you. It is a quality that includes the essential human virtues, compassion, and humanity. And let's face it, people got to be free, right, Steve?
Right.
Right? They got to get a fair shake, right?
Right.
They cannot be kept down by the powers that be forever. And if they can... goodness help us all. So, if you want to dance and you want to think deep thoughts and you want to do something that feels right inside, check out Ubuntu Conscious Music Festival, Sunday, Monday, Uptown Theater, right?
And
right.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 enduring things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. Let's move on here and talk about It's a Wonderful Life.
Okay, we all know It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
And sometimes if we're lucky, we get to lead one, right?
Yes.
It's the 1946... the enduring 1946 film classic that actually will have a holiday stage show version performed as if it were a live radio play from the 1940s. That's going to happen at 7:30 tonight, Friday night, and Saturday night, and again at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday at the Metropolitan Ensemble Theater in Midtown. Let's listen.
Sounds cool.
It is cool because we'll talk about how cool it is just a bit more, but let's go back to that 1946 classic. A certain totally depressed man has tried to commit suicide. His guardian angel has rescued him. And here's what the guardian angel and this man who has perhaps better, perhaps worse days ahead talk about.
Yeah, so you still think killing yourself would make everyone feel happier, eh?
Oh, I don't know. I guess you're right. I suppose it'd been better if I'd never been born at all.
What'd you say?
I said I wish I'd never been born.
Oh, you mustn't say things like that. Wait a minute. That's an idea.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
That is an idea. So check out As Done like a radio play from the 1940s. So you get this like old school special effects production, you know, the techniques, how the wind machine and all sorts of bells and whistles. It's theater of the mind and a wonderful story of what can happen if you don't give up.
You've got to have heart.
Oh, there's Eddie Fisher. I haven't heard him in a while. Hey, and we're listening to him sing because...
Because I'm making you listen to him, because yes. I bring back the old voices of yesteryear for yes. appropriately modern reasons. Okay, so who's got heart? Well, the Heartland Men's Chorus, they have heart, especially their annual holiday show extravaganza. This year it's called Packages with Bows, not the bows on gifts, but, you know, the bows, maybe your boyfriend, right? Those bows. So Kansas City's volunteer chorus of gay and gay-sensitive folks, founded in 1986, they're back with this great show. It's actually at the Folly Theater this weekend, 8 o'clock Saturday, 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon. Also next week, on the 10th of December, if you happen to miss it, and don't miss it, see it more than once this weekend at the Folly. But in the first half, it's sacred music, it's traditional music, and in the second half, it's drag queens with candy cane earrings and spiked eggnog backstage, and who knows what else. It's zany, it's zealous, and it's heartfelt. Heartland Men's Chorus this weekend at the Folly.
Lot 81 is a 1979 10th anniversary Trans Am with only 5,000 miles. It's in highly original condition. Same owner since 1991. 6.6 liter engine, 4-speed, factory air, power steering, brakes, windows, locks, glass T-tops, 8-track, 4-speed, 5,000 miles.
And what's all this
about? Okay, listen,
about?
listen. Okay, all right. That's what you're going to get an earful of at the Mecum Collector Cars Auction, right? Collector cars go to the highest bidders. It's 3 4 days of this, 3 days. 1 o'clock Thursday, 10 o'clock in the morning, Friday and Saturday, down at Bartle Hall. Hey, bring your wallet, or at least bring that longing look that says, I wish I brought my wallet, because they're going to have all kinds of crazy 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, fantastic cars that, whether you can afford them or not, be part of it. And check out that 1956 Corvette pedal car for kiddies. What's that worth? Thousands of dollars.
Okay. That's Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list. Thank you.
Did you have a pedal car?
I did not.
I did not either.
Yeah, maybe I did.
Oh, you can't remember.
I can't remember.
Really?
But that's going back a few years.
Just stuck in the garage, I guess, huh? Okay.
Our podcast and previous programs, including my conversation with Gold Star Father Keyser Khan, are all posted at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow we'll get you the info you need to enroll in health insurance on the federal marketplace. The deadline for that is December 15th. We'll also explore the connection between antibiotics and modern agriculture. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.